It was 46 episodes ago, back in chapter 55, that I spent an entire chapter focusing upon the conditions and circumstances that led to the First Crusade, and reflected upon the Crusade's impact upon London. Back then, King William II was in power, and his baby brother Henry I was seizing the throne, and London was suffering from years of calamity and packs of wild dogs running rampant around St. Paul's Cathedral. Well, here we are at chapter 101, and the Crusades are just about to come to an end. Of course, at the time, no one knew that the Crusades were about to come to an end. Most folks thought crusading was here to stay for a while, but the saga of the nations of Outre-mer were finally ending, even if their impact upon London was to remain for a while yet. But as I mentioned all the way back in chapter 55, and as I've mentioned last episode, for London, the story was to end on a flourish, because leading the forces to the Holy Land was none other than Edward, heir to the throne of England, and named ruler of the city of London. And his journey there, I believe, is a tale worthy of telling, so I'll give my version of it, hopefully in an entertaining manner. And then after that, I'm going to cover what was happening in London while he was away. Hi, my name is Saul, and you are listening to The Story of London, a lone antiquarian's quest to turn the history of the city into a single narrative tale. I do not claim to offer the definitive version of events, but will always try and say when I'm simplifying things or missing out details, and hope to present a comprehensive and full guide to the history of the city in a way folks find interesting and engaging. You can listen to each episode as a standalone, or maybe, hopefully, as one continually long, incredibly long monologue. We begin this year around about 1272 and cover the events of that last war in the Holy Land and the elevation of Edward I of England. Welcome then to chapter 101 of The Story of London, the city of the Last Crusade. So, why the hell was Prince Edward going on a crusade? Well, from the point of view of the Crusader states and their supporters, the Middle East desperately needed one. And why? Well, because of one man. Al-Malik al-Zahir Rakan al-Din Baybars al-Bundukari, also known simply as Baybars. He was born on the shores of the Black Sea, tall, with olive skin, blue eyes and a cataract. Baybars' life story had been something you would assume you would only ever see in a Hollywood movie. He was a Kipchak, a group of Turkish nomads, and had ended up becoming enslaved by various peoples, and then eventually he ended up becoming a Mamluk, slaves who earned their freedom fighting in the armies of Islam. In time, the Mamluks had become a power unto themselves and went on to overthrow the Sultanate of the descendants of Salah ad-Din in Egypt. Baybars had already gained fame for leading troops to effectively destroy the forces of the Seventh Crusade, but had managed since then to position himself to become the Sultan of Egypt. Baybars was slowly, but with relentless ferocity, winding up the last few Crusader holdings in Syria. By 1265, Caesarea and Asef fell to the Mamluks, and the castle of Safed followed in 1266. 2 years later, Jaffa fell, and the Principality of Antioch collapsed. The Kingdom of Jerusalem was a mess. Alexignan, who was the king of Cyprus, a man called Hugh, was nominally the king of Jerusalem, but the whole place seemed doomed. King Louis of France, however, wanted to change the situation. His first crusade, the Seventh Crusade, had taken place all the way back in 1248, and it ended up being focused on the region around the mouth of the Nile. It had been an utter failure, and King Louis had been ransomed and released. He remained in what constituted the Kingdom of Jerusalem until 1254, but he had achieved little while he was there. King Louis wanted to go back to the Middle East. He desperately wanted to restore the Kingdom of Jerusalem. But European politics got in the way and the French were not ready to launch a new crusade until 1266. In the meantime, a few minor crusading forces had gone over, including something we called the Barons' Crusade, which I mentioned in a previous chapter and which contained Simon de Montfort. However, by the mid-1260s, the French were ready to launch a crusade and they tapped the Pope to organise it. Pope Urban IV began to, well, send out word he was starting it again. And this is where we need to mention somebody I mentioned a few episodes ago. Ottobuono, the papal legate and Pope's heavy, who had been sent to England to crap onto the English church for sitting on the fence during the rebellion of Simon de Montfort. As well as doing that, he was, as I said a couple of episodes ago, also preaching this new crusade because it was being led by the King of France. And guess what? His preaching worked. Because he managed to recruit Prince Edward. Enthusiasm for this crusade was not really widespread. This was not like the first couple of crusades where there was a deep body of normal people who were just driven by religious passion to take the cross. Both the French Royal Council and the English Parliament rejected supporting the crusade. But Ottobuono persisted, having to preach using interpreters, and this led to a carefully planned aristocratic military campaign being organised, and in 1268 at a parliament in Northampton, Edward, along with his brother Edmund, his cousin Henry of Almaine, Earl Warrenne, the Earl of Gloucester, William de Valence, and many others, all agreed, yes, they were going to go on crusade. It was not an especially large force, probably numbering less than 1,000 all told, maybe a bit over, but no more than 300 of them were knights. It was also hideously expensive, and I could talk about how Edward needed to finance his expedition at length, but I'm choosing to ignore it for the sake of brevity. Suffice to say that it took him until 1270 to organise the funds required for even this modest crusading expedition. In August 1270, Prince Edward crossed the Channel with his forces to join up with the French. But the French had already left and Edward was playing catch-up. King Louis of France and the massive French crusade were ahead of him, having gathered in Sardinia before heading off for their target. Only, and apparently one of the last moments before they decided to go, the king declared that he was not going to sail towards Jerusalem. The target of this crusade would be Tunis, on the North African coast. People had convinced King Louis to attack Tunis, because they told him this would weaken Egypt, which was dependent on food supplies from this region, and that would force Berbers to send men away from the Holy Land. As well as this, there was a belief that the local emir of Tunis was possibly willing to convert to Christianity. It should also be noted at this point that the king's son, a prince called Charles of Anjou, who was also nominally King of Sicily at this time, had an axe to grind with the ruler of Tunis because he owed him a lot of money, and that could probably have been his principal reasoning for supporting an attack upon Tunis. But who can say for sure? Attacking Tunis was seen as a bit of an easy warm-up campaign for the crusade. But in truth, the entire thing was a terrible mistake. The crusaders landed, began to besiege Tunis, but the unsanitary conditions of a siege, mixed with the heat of a North African summer, led to the large force of Europeans being decimated by disease. King Louis of France himself died on the plains of North Tunisia on August 25th, just as Edward was making his way south, and the king's heir, the new King Philip III of France, was laid low by disease also, only just recovering. By the time Prince Edward and his English forces sailed into Tunis that November, the whole thing was over, or at least the Tunis part of this campaign. A formal ceasefire had been declared, and Prince Charles of Anjou had managed to get the Emir of Tunis to cough up a load of cash in return for the crusaders leaving. Edward was by all accounts appalled at this situation. The image I have in my head of Edward's response is, I can't help it, it's a little bit like seeing Tom Hardy in his portrayal of one of the Cray brothers in a recent movie. "I came here
for a crusade, like was real religious war. Edward refused to go along with this settlement, but he was in no position to attack it himself, so he just seized with resentment. Even when Charles of Anjou was all like, "Ah, Prince Edward, as a leader, you're entitled to some of this money we have just gained from the Muslims." Edward refused. Edward wanted a real crusade. Still, he did take on board and agree that with the French decision, again being advocated by Charles of Anjou, that the best decision would be for the crusade to sail back to Sicily, spend their winter there, and then in the spring, sail to Acre, the capital of the crusader state of Jerusalem. That made sense. I mean, it just looked like, yes, the commander-in-chief, an experienced crusader, Holy King Louis, may have just been browbeaten into attack a target hundreds of miles away from where he intended to go. And yes, he did die and our army was devastated by plague and ended up basically failing. But we can regroup, give each other a jolly pep talk, and sail off in the good weather to the coast of Palestine, and there meet interesting and awesome foreign people and kill them. Plan's a good un. And so the grand fleet of the crusade got to Sicily. Now, what happened next does suggest that Edward was still a little bit salty over everything, and he was in a bit of a sulk. He decided to anchor his smaller English fleet away from where the French were dumping their fleet. Now, that's my interpretation. I have to say he may not have done this because he was sulking at them. It could be that after months of being boiled alive in the sun and suffering from monster diarrhea, the French just turned up at the coast of Sicily and were like, "Oh, just anchor the bloody ships already, we just want to go ashore." While Edward's less traumatised crews were like, "No, your majesty, we should anchor over here, sir. Much more secure place to base yourself." But for whatever reason, Edward's English fleet was not at anchor off the coast of Sicily in the same place as the rest of the Crusader fleet. And I'm mentioning this because a winter storm suddenly blew in. Huge waves, violent winds, and the French ships were mostly torn apart by it. French ships still packed with horses for the French knights, the supplies and food for the French troops, and the monies required to pay for things as the Crusades went along were all wrecked off the coast of Sicily. And the French Crusaders took one look at the carnage the next day, lit a metaphorical equivalent of a 13th century Galois, and simply went mad. Edward and his ships, they were fine, but the Crusade, it was screwed. In the discussions that followed, the Crusaders basically went, "You know what, we should all go home, not forever home. How about we go home, resupply, and we all agree 3 years from now, we'll try again." Edward agreed to this decision, but it was clear he was conflicted. He didn't want to go home. He remained in Sicily. And indeed, he eventually set out four conditions which would get him to return to England. And they were: A, a new pope was elected, and that new pope specifically forbade him from sailing to the Holy Land. B, if he suddenly became very poorly. C, if his father, King Henry, snuffed it. Or D, a civil war started in England. By February 1271, a letter arrived that should have triggered Clause C. The letter said the king was very poorly. But you see, very poorly is not dead. And Edward, who is clearly all up in his... "No, seriously, actually, I really do want a crusade mentality." So he stayed in Sicily and sent his first cousin, Henry of Almaine, to leave Sicily, travel to Gascony, and then sail to England, and to see for him just how poorly his father was. Edward was so determined to go to the Holy Land that even soon after, when he got news that Henry of Almaine was murdered on the way by the sons of Simon de Montfort, Simon and Guy de Montfort, as revenge for what Edward did to their father at the Battle of Evesham, yeah, even that wasn't going to dissuade him from going on crusade. And yeah, Edward decided, "I'm doing this." And so in May 1271, he and his ship sailed east from Sicily. towards the Holy Land. After a brief stop on the way in Cyprus, Prince Edward and his crusading force from England finally arrived at the mighty crusading port of Acre. Edward turned up expecting to find a small but plucky enclave of fiery Christians besieged and ready to bring holy war upon the Muslims, screaming Deus Vult as they commit acts of daring do. What he found was a cynical city where folks were all about making money and staying alive just for another year. He discovered Venetian merchants based in the city were openly trading with the enemy in food and military supplies. Edward spluttered and demanded they stop, right up until the Venetians supplied the paperwork, which quietly said the King of Jerusalem had given permission for them to do this. Sorry, signori. Furiously, Edward had dropped the matter, but he did find some residents of Acre who were selling secrets and giving information to Baber's people, and he could at least have them rounded up and executed. But on the 13th of June, 1271, Baber's himself apparently rode right up to the gates of Acre on some business, and Edward watched as the residents were all like, "Ah, Sultan, how can we help you today?" And no one made any move against the guy who everybody knew was the enemy. The moral ambiguity of the Middle East seems to have caused Prince Edward to find this whole experience extremely stressful. May I remind you that Edward didn't deal with stress very well. As it was by late June, Edward finally snapped and led his forces out to begin attacking Muslims like you were supposed to do on a crusade. And they marched about 15 miles east of the city. But his men had never marched in such heat before, and the combined effects of heat along with food poisoning actually killed more of his men than any enemy. When he got there, all he could do was burn some crops and destroy some houses. Still, crusading, eh? He was finally doing crusading things. And then he marched back, and he realized he needed a lot more men if he was going to get anything done. Still, Edward was nothing if not determined. He sent diplomatic letters to the nearby Khan of the Mongol forces, which was basically him saying, "Yo, dude, fancy doing a double team on these Egyptians?" And he then dealt with some big internal arguments between the King of Jerusalem, who was living in Cyprus, as we said, and the remaining barons of the Kingdom of Jerusalem about how much service they would render him. And the aim for all of this was to take his people and unite them with other forces, and it seems to have worked. By that autumn, the Mongols were suddenly advancing towards Syria, and that caused total panic, and many residents in Damascus fled the city at the news of their approach. And then that November, Prince Edward was able to launch a much larger attack upon the Muslims. Reinforcements from England had arrived with his brother Edmund in September, and the Cypriots were now ready to join, and the Knights Templar and the Knights Hospitaller and the Teutonic Knights were also up for this, and he now even been so impressive in his organisation that the men of Acre even supplied forces. This new task force, Edward, marched out into the Middle East, targeting a small town called Kakun, 40 miles southeast of Acre, where his force surprised a large number of Turkomans. Here he won an actual battle. One estimate suggests that as many as 1,500 enemy were killed and 5,000 animals taken as booty. Muslim reports say one emir had been killed, another wounded, and the governor of the nearby castle was forced to abandon his command. Victory! Well, not a full victory. The crusaders never actually got round to taking the castle itself because they heard a new Muslim force was on its way, so they retreated rapidly back to Acre. And they retreated so rapidly that they lost some men and horses on the way back. And let's be honest, the Turkomans they'd just routed were no more than itinerant herdsmen with swords. But still, it was a victory. A glorious tale of daring do, like what his great uncle Richard Coeur de Lion had done. That December, Baber's march from Damascus, seeking to retaliate, but bad weather made the attack impossible to do, and Baber's gave up and went home, all soggy, to Egypt. Edward was on a roll, but it didn't last for long. I mean, in 1272, when the new year dawned, Edward seemed to be living the dream. He was a crusader in the Holy Land, attacking Muslims and stuff. Glorious. However, it soon became clear that the Mongols were not really here to launch a massive campaign against Syria, just a bit of raiding, and Baybars opened talks with them. And then by May 1272, a truce between Acre and Baybars was agreed at Caesarea to last for 10 years, 10 months, 10 days, and 10 hours. Edward was reportedly furious at this. Here he was in the Holy Land, and ultimately all he'd done is just buy 11 years worth of peace. Clearly, as the dynamic leader of the Western forces in the region, he did not like the peace deal. He was hoping to restart the war again. And then that June, something happened. Arguably the most epic moment of this English prince's life so far. There was an assassination attempt upon him. Now, there are many accounts of this incident, and like many events from this long ago, the sources do not always agree. We have to take on board that many of the accounts are written long after the fact, and historians like to, well, they like to add flourishes to make a dramatic moment sound more dramatic. What we can say for sure is that a Muslim came to see Prince Edward when he was alone in his chambers. At the meeting, the Muslim attacked Edward and either stabbed him or slashed him with a supposedly poisoned dagger. Edward, for his part, reacted quickly, kicked out at the assassin and got into a fight with the man. In this desperate struggle, the English prince managed to kill his assailant. This is not a glamorous moment, no matter what anybody says. Now, later writers insist that it wasn't just an assassin, but the attacker was an actual assassin, the devotee of the fanatical quasi-heretical Ismaili sect of Muslims commanded by the mysterious figure of the Old Man of the Mountains. But I tend to side with the more conservative historians who favour the idea that the attempted assassin had been prompted or sent by the emir of nearby Ramla, perhaps acting on Baybar's instigation, and that the cause of the attack was Edward's opposition to the truce. From the description, it sounds like the assassin was not a stranger to Edward, because he managed to get a one-to-one meeting with the prince, suggesting it was someone who was known to Edward and his entourage, someone who had become a trusted before the attack happened. Now, where the sources really disagree is not so much about the attack, but over the means used to cure him afterwards. And now the most Hollywood description is of how his wife, Eleanor of Castile, personally sucked poison from the wound inflicted by the assassin's dagger. But that version only appeared in one source, written about 100 years after the attack. Another version from around the same time said that someone called Otto de Grandson sucked the poison out of the wound. But he alone had suggested that the weapon may have been poisoned, and that's why he did it. A third version says that Prince Edward had been given a special magical jewel by the Grand Master of the Knights of the Temple, and it was ground up and added to a drink to cure the poison. Still, between all these accounts and a couple of others, we have some idea of what probably happened. The Master of the Temple probably did offer some weird cure, but it didn't work, and the wound inflicted upon Prince Edward began to putrefy. Edward began to despair of his life. Richard the Lionheart, after all, had died of an infected wound years before. It was inevitable unless treated. He was also going to die. The account suggests that an English doctor said that he could cure him, although the cure would be painful. Edward agreed to the treatment, which involved cutting off the decayed flesh away from the wound. Remarkably enough, this worked, but it was probably incredibly painful, very gory, and would have left one hell of a scar. Yet Edward survived, but he was going to need a while to recover. Slowly Edward recovered from the stabbing, and even more worse, the surgery used to cure him of the stabbing. and then his wife gave birth to a daughter called Joan. And it would have been very risky for a sea voyage with the baby in its first few months of life, so Edward stuck around and busied himself in strengthening the defences of Acre. He ordered the building of a new fortified tower there. 6 years later, this tower was to be placed in the hands of a brand new crusading order of knights, the Order of St. Edward of Acre. Who the hell were the Order of the Knights of St. Edward of Acre? We actually have no idea. We think they were made up of a handful of Englishmen left behind in Acre to carry on the war against Babers. But whatever the case, after months of recovering, Edward finally got on a boat to return to Italy and then home. He had not liberated Jerusalem. In fact, he had not actually done much. But he was a crusader, the last crusading king. And one thing I've got to stress again, all of this had cost Prince Edward a bloody fortune. Like, seriously, an utter and total fortune in cash. Again, I could talk long about the financial affairs of the king-to-be and make a really big thing and stress about how the Riccardi family of Italian financiers were acting as his main agents and fundraisers. But honestly, it's not important for now. Edward's relationship with Italian financiers will become really important later on in the story of London. But for right now, all we need to know is that Edward was coming home from Crusade and up to his neck in debt for it, but had a great line of credit from a bunch of Italians. Got that? Let's move on. And while his crusade had done little for the Kingdom of Jerusalem, it had certainly helped his profile. Edward was a crusader. He'd led forces and won battles in the Middle East. For the nobles of Europe, this was like him living the dream. And that assassination attempt, oh, Edward was returning to Europe like a rock star. He'd also made some important friends while on Crusades, men who would go on to serve him for quite some time. Otto de Grandson starts appearing after the Crusade as one of Edward's most trusted henchmen. Joseph de Chauncy, the prior of the English Hospital and Knights, was recruited into Edward's service to be his treasurer. In Acre, he met an Italian lawyer called Francesco Accursi, who went on to serve him. While he was in Acre, he also met some really interesting people, like Tedaldo Visconti, a man who would very soon become Pope Gregory X. And some speculated that when he was in Acre, he would have met a bunch of Italian traders called Polo, who were in Acre at the same time, and have met the Polo brothers and the son of one of them, a young man called Marco Polo. Anyway, when Edward arrived in Sicily, he was greeted as a rock star, but given sad news. Firstly, of the death of his young son, John. And then, of the death of his father, Henry III, who's died, as we mentioned last chapter, on the 16th of November. The story goes that his host, Charles of Anjou, was surprised to find him unconcerned about the news of his son, but supposedly extremely upset about the death of his father. The story goes that Edward, when asked, said it was easy to beget more sons, but a father was irredeemable. Edward, however, did not hurry back to England. And his journey back was an incredibly leisurely one. A letter from the Pope to Eleanor of Castile suggested that Edward was still recovering from the effects of that assassination attempt. 2 months later, in January 1273, he was still in southern Italy. By early February, he reached Rome and then Orvieto, where he was greeted by all the cardinals and led before the Pope in a grand ceremony. And this new Pope was, of course, Gregory X, who he'd met back in the Holy Land. From there, he had slowly travelled in some glory through Lombardy, stopping in Reggio, Parma and Milan, before reaching the Alpine passes of Montsenus, which was controlled by the House of Savoy, his mother's family. It's worth remembering the House of Savoy were incredibly powerful at this point in history, despite the small size of their lands. Four female members of the same family had married four kings,
the late Louis IX of France, the late Henry III of England, the late Richard of Cornwall, King of the Germans, and the current King of Sicily, Charles of Anjou. England had, as I've mentioned, Savoyards being in positions of influence in the kingdom for years, and new ones were coming along, like Otto the Grandson was a Savoyard. If Italy treated Prince Edward, now King Edward, like a rock star, Savoy treated him like a conquering hero, and he was feted and acclaimed at almost every corner. It was around now that his personal connections to England grew, with various English magnates had come to Savoy in order to meet their new sovereign. And it was here that Edward first met the man who was to be the master architect for all his great castles in Wales, Master James of St. George, a Savoyard whose imaginative solutions to the problems of castle building placed him amongst the ranks of the greatest of all military architects. Master James of St. George did not return to England with Edward, but he was sent for within the next few years. Edward now travelled into France, and his last adventures took place. He went to stay with the Count of Chalons, a Bungarian called Peter, and he invited the English king to join his people in a tournament. Now, tournaments were not courtly affairs, where noble knights jousting one-on-one at this point. No, they were far more like mock battles, free-for-alls taking place across whole fields. And in this tournament, it was Edward's forces against all comers. Most accounts say that the English were at 2-1 disadvantage, but still it went on. The whole affair was very badly managed and badly organised, and from the very start it was barely distinguishable from an actual full-scale battle. Infantry attacks upon the English were routed, and then the Count, Peter, decided to charge. He attacked Edward like a bull from a gate. The Count realised he could not defeat the new king in a straight fight, so threw away his sword and grabbed Edward by the neck, trying to personally drag him from his horse. Now, Edward was known as Longshanks for a reason. He was too tall and too strong for such treatment. So he just kicked his horse, and Count Peter ended up being dragged from his saddle and falling to the ground. The Burgundians saw their count humiliated like this, and started getting angry and really attacking the English, and Edward, now being pissed off, ordered his guys to do the same. The Count attacked again, but the veteran crusaders made short work of them, and the Count surrendered. And Edward refused to take his surrender, insisted a Norman knight do it as a huge diss. This entire event, the Little War of Chalons, luckily did not escalate. And I just tell it because it's a hell of an illustration to noble traditions and also what Edward was like. Edward finally reached Paris, where he stayed from the 26th of July until the 6th of August. Here he did homage to the new French king, Philippe III, for lands he held in France. And then, speaking of that, he got word that there was a serious rebellion against him taking place in Gascony. And so in 1273 he went to Gascony and ended up staying almost for a year while dealing with the issues there. It was not until August 1274 that Edward, King of England, finally arrived back and stood upon English soil. But from the February before he came back, Edward had started making plans for his triumphant return to England and to London and his eventual coronation. Orders had gone out to dozens of counties across the country for the collection of massive amounts of food needed for the feast that would accompany his actual coronation. I mean, from Gloucestershire alone, he ordered 60 oxen and cows, 60 swine, 2 fat boars, 40 bacon pigs, and 3,000 capons and hens. And 2 Londoners, by the way, were appointed to make these purchases of food on behalf of the king. Work was started to prepare Westminster for the glorious ceremony to come. Over £1,100 was spent on the palace for new lodges, new kitchens and stables. And by the time he was due to arrive, every piece of open ground had been used for temporary buildings for the guests. Westminster Palace was redecorated, new stone thrones were set up in the Great Hall, along with brand new covered ways to erect it between the palace and the Abbey Church, just in case it rained. On the day before he was crowned, August 18th, Edward made a triumphant entry into London, which was decorated in his honour, and the next day saw the great water conduit at Cheapside running with red and white wine for all to drink. Glory, glory, glory. Which begs the question, you know, while all that was going on, what had London been up to? Well, it had been busy. Badly busy. See, you just got to go back to the era just before King Henry III died. While Edward was rampaging across the Middle East on crusade, London was all up in being furious at itself. The records say that, quote, "The citizens of London, as their custom is, met together for the election of mayor in Guildhall on the feast of Simon and Jude," unquote, which is around October 28th. The mayor of London at this point was a man called Walter Hervey. However, at this time, the, quote, "aldermen and more discreet citizens would have chosen Philip le Taylor," unquote, to become mayor of the city instead of him. However, Walter Hervey, the incumbent mayor, was incredibly popular. And so popular, however, that the records of our German chronicler, Arnold Thedmer, says, quote, "the mob of the city, opposing such election and making a great tumult, cried aloud, 'Nay, nay, we will have no one for mayor but Walter Hervey, who before was mayor, and against the will of the rest with all their might, placed him in the seat of the mayoralty,'" unquote. So this is just like the incidents we'd seen a few chapters ago with Mayor Thomas FitzThomas. The commons of the city had a mayor they were very supportive of, Walter Hervey, and they refused to allow the oligarchs of the city pick their candidate. This confrontation escalated quickly. Quote, "the aldermen, however, and many discreet men who sided with them, being unable to make head against the vast multitude of a countless populace, immediately went to his lordship the king and his council at Westminster. And Walter Hervey, taking with him the populace, proceeded thither in the like manner," unquote. So yeah, immediately the oligarchs of the city were going, "we're going to see the king." And the mayor went, "well, so are we." Why were so many of the population supportive of Hervey? Well, his policies and election promises seem to have made him popular. As the sources say, he promised that, quote, "he would preserve them one and all through the whole time of his mayoralty, exempt from all tallages, extractions and tolls, and would keep the city acquitted of its debts, both towards the Queen as towards all other persons, out of the arrears in the role of the city chamberlain contained," unquote. So he was offering a large amount of financial prudency to the debts that the city owed that they had been extracting from its citizens. And it also appears that he was beginning to grant charters and protections to the various tradesmen, establishing proto-guilds of the city. No wonder he was so popular. Of course, the record keeper of all of this was the oligarch Arnold, the German, and he was not going to talk about this administration without putting shade on it, because he was clearly a supporter of Philip le Taylor. Arnold wrote, quote, "but still this mayor endeavoured to extort from said citizens a great sum of money, and always made promises to the populace with affirmation of his good faith, as already written. And accordingly the populace, believing it to be true as he had promised, became his adherents and submitted themselves to their will," unquote. So yeah, he was saying that the mayor was lying. For whatever political reason, the people supported the incumbent mayor. And as Arnold said, quote, "the people, by hundreds, by thousands, and by multitude of persons without number, followed him at his command, both on horseback and on foot," unquote. If the aldermen were going to see the king in Westminster and say, "please let us choose our mayor," the mayor was bringing almost the whole of London to back him up to stay in position. The showdown between the two sides was to go down on October 28th, and, quote, "said aldermen and their adherents, on coming before his lordship the king and his council, showed unto them, with grievous complaints, how that this populace by force
had violently and unjustly impeded their election by those to whom the election of mayor and sheriffs in the city of right more particularly belongs to than anyone else, and had always been wont to belong, unquote. Damn it, we picked the mayors of the city. The damn people of London are getting uppity again, Your Majesty. Please side with us.
Arnold's account details the careful, peevish arrangements the oligarchs had prepared for the meeting with the King's Council. Quote,
they also besought his lordship the King and his council that the King would be pleased to set his arm and his hand thereto, so that this populace, calling itself the commons of the city, and excluding the aldermen and discreet men off the city, might not upraise itself against the peace, and against the peace of his realm, as had happened in the time of the Earl of Leicester. Unquote. See, if the King didn't tell these poor people to obey the rich people, it would be just like when Simon de Montfort was in charge, and if we let them decide who gets to be mayor, it could drag all of England into a full-blown civil war. Honest.
You can almost hear the shrill triggering of a bunch of rich men being told they cannot do what they want to do. It should be noted, the rest of London was there.
Quote, the populace, however, showing no reason against this, but making a great tumult in the King's Hall, so much so that the noise reached his lordship the King in bed, to which he was confined by severe illness,
was continually crying aloud, we are the commons of the city, unto us belongs the election of the mayor, and it is our will distinctly that Walter Hervey should be mayor, whom we have chosen, unquote.
No matter how Arnold words the debate, history is not kind to his account. The overwhelming population of London wanted Mayor Walter to remain in office, and a bunch of rich guys wanted to choose their candidate to hold the post. And their shrill pearl-clutching fears now includes descriptions of how uncouth the Londoner protesters were at trying to steal their election. Look, they're upsetting the poorly King. How could they?
Arnold's words show the natural arrogance of the city's oligarchs laid bare. And while I'm sure he felt this explanation of why the city should be run the way it was perfectly reasonable, it kind of reveals the oligarchs of London were basically a bunch of douche canoes. I mean, listen to this, quote, but on the other hand, the aldermen showed by many reasons that unto them belongs the election of the mayor, both because they, the aldermen, are the heads, as it were, and the populace the limbs, and also because it is the aldermen who pronounce all judgment and pleas moved within the city. Of the populace, on the other hand, there are many who have neither lands, rents, nor dwellings in the city, some sons of diverse mothers, some of them of servile station, and all of them caring little or nothing about the city's welfare, unquote. Oh, we are such smart rich men, and they are the poors. And some of them have dodgy mothers. Of course the King should listen to us.
As a Londoner, I think I speak for all residents of the city today by saying that we stand with our ancient forebears, stood in the King's Hall of Westminster, which is there to this day, and giving voice against the bullshit going on. The account goes on to say, quote, the populace, however, still kept crying aloud as before, whereupon the members of the King's Council, wishing to give offence to neither the alderman's party nor that of the populace, and to end that the King, who is in a weak state, might not be in any way disturbed, dismissed them until tomorrow, and told the said Walter that he must not come to court attended by such a vast multitude of people, but only with 10 or 12 persons at most. And after this had been told them, they all returned to the city, unquote. And so the council had used the King's illness as an excuse to send everyone home for 24 hours and then told the mayor to come back with less people. So what did the mayor do? Quote, accordingly, on the morrow, a countless multitude went with him, both horse and foot, to Westminster, and there, entering the King's Hall,
set forth no reasons, but just as they'd done before, kept crying aloud and saying, "It is our will that Walter Hervey shall be our mayor, because no person in the city is so fit and proper to govern us," unquote. Glorious. The Londoners just came back and filled the King's Hall in Westminster. At the same time, quote, the aldermen too were present, awaiting the answer of his lordship the King and Council, unquote. So the rich guys had turned up. Instead of having to deal with just a dozen residents, Mayor Hervey had brought the city with him, who were chanting again. Oh God, they're chanting again. And for the King's Council, this was clearly a London problem, not a them problem. Quote, the members of the King's Council told the aldermen and the others who were adherents of said Walter that they themselves should unanimously have given their assent to any person in the city whom they might have thought proper to be mayor, and that if they should present such a person unto his lordship the King would admit him to the mayoralty. The populace, however, always kept crying aloud for already mentioned. For all this, the parties aforesaid could not obtain an answer from the King and his council for several days, unquote. This problem was lasting day after day. The stalemate about who should be mayor of London continued, right up until around the 11th of November. Finally, after this had dragged out for this long, the King's Council had enough. Quote, the members of the King's Council, seeing that it would be of no use any further delay in this matter, called before them the aldermen, as well as Walter and his adherents, and said to them, his lordship the King wishes to preserve all your liberties unimpaired, and as you cannot unanimously agree to the election of the same person as mayor, it is his will that both Walter Hervey and Philip Le Taylor shall be removed from the mayoralty, and that you shall have a warden from amongst ourselves for whom we may keep the city on his behalf. And immediately thereupon, Henry de Frowick was made warden of the city to keep the same until the feast of St. Hilary, unquote. Yep, the King said, until you pick somebody, I'll appoint a warden, and he's going to hold it until next January the 13th. The King hoped this would make one of the sides back down. But guess what? It didn't. The political crisis in London may have been kicked down the road for a few weeks, but the two sides would simply not compromise. And behind the scenes, moves were made to resolve the issue. Who should be mayor? Walter Hervey or Walter Harvey serving a second term, or Philip Le Taylor serving his first? Quote, after this, certain persons of the King's Council, namely Walter de Merton and others, came into the city and for several days held conference with the said alderman and the said Walter for the purpose of making peace and concord, whereupon it was common agreed that five men should be chosen upon the alderman's side and five on the side of said Walter, and that the person whom they would elect should be mayor for that year, unquote. So the two sides agreed to talks where there would just be 10 of them, and these 10 men would decide who was mayor. Who was on the oligarch side? Well, you've got, quote, John Adrian, Walter Le Poulter, Henry Le Wales, Henry Le Coventry, and Thomas Le Bassingy, unquote. There's some interesting names in there. John Adrian, I've mentioned before. He's a loyalist to the King's faction, former bailiff of the city, and a former mayor of London. And there's a new and interesting name on that list we should mention. Henry Le Wales. Who's he? Well, he was an outsider to the city. Henry may well have been born in Wales, hence his name. But he'd come to London and made a fortune via the wine trade. He'd been appointed an alderman in 1269 for the Cordwain Award and had become sheriff back in 1270. And here he is representing the oligarch faction. And opposite them, you had Mayor Walter's faction. And they included, quote, Robert Greatfig, Robert Hootin, Alan de Hura, Bartholomew Le Spicer, and Henry de Winchester, unquote. Again, some interesting names in there, including Robert Greatfig, presumably the son or relative of Walter Greatfig, the civil leader who'd been killed at the Battle of Lewes. And so this body of 10 men had been arranged to thrash out who should be mayor. But as Arnold admits, quote, This provision, however, an agreement, was never carried into effect, unquote. And the reason why? Henry III died. Quote, for immediately the king was dead, the Archbishop of York, the Earl of Gloucester, and many other nobles of England came into the city and caused peace to be proclaimed towards all persons, Jews as well as Christians, unquote, which was nice of them. But as they're declaring all of this, it's clear they walk in to London's ongoing political crisis. Quote, they came into the chamber of the Guildhall, where the alderman and the aforesaid Walter, with a countless multitude of people, were assembled. And upon hearing the disagreement that existed between the alderman and said Walter, the Earl, before named, seeing such a vast multitude of people adhering to this Walter, in order that the quiet of the city may not be disturbed, requested that he might just be admitted to the mayoralty, unquote. So yeah, here we are, the king is dead, and the very much now restored to favour Earl of Gloucester took one look at this huge body of Londoners and went, well, he clearly has the support, so let's stop pissing about and bloody well make him mayor again. Now, listeners could well be thinking that I'm being unfair towards the oligarchs of London at this point. And I will say, why, yes, I am. Right now, to me, the aldermen and oligarchs of the city come across like a bunch of spoilt man babies who are simply upset they're not getting to do what they wanted to do. I mean, after the Earl of Gloucester had said this, listen to the wording of how they reacted. Quote, but the alderman told him that the matter had been referred to the arbitration of 10 men, in manner already stated, unquote. But we've already picked our 5 men. The Earl of Gloucester was having none of this. Quote, the Earl, however, disregarding this arbitration, commanded that on the morrow, Friday namely, a folk moot should be called together in the churchyard at St. Paul's Cross, and that he should continue to be mayor for that year, to whose election the greater part of the citizens should agree, unquote. Walter Hervey and his supporters had won. He was to serve a second term. At St. Paul's Churchyard, a leading body of men of the kingdom, including now the Archbishop of Canterbury, advised the aldermen and the oligarchs, quote, to agree to the election of this Walter, so long as he should be mayor for 1 year only, lest something still worse might happen in the city, unquote. So Walter Hervey, or Walter Harvey, was elected mayor for a second term, but alas, Walter was only to serve a second term. And was that it? Well, not quite. We read from Arnold's Records of London that Mayor Harvey's administration was accused of bribery. The sheriffs of his administration were supposedly not fining bakers for short measures and taking bribes to look the other way. And in the end, the oligarchs arranged for Walter Harvey's second term to end in ignominy. And upon his fall from power, the oligarchs duly elected Henry Le Wales to become mayor of the city, the Welsh-born wine merchant made good. And he was to go on to serve for 5 terms. But we'll get to him in a later episode. The city of the Last Crusader, then, is a place where a new order was in town. The furious Prince Edward had now returned King Edward. Edward's glorious coronation heralded a new era, one where the populist parties around the likes of Thomas FitzThomas and Walter Hervey, they'd had their time. And yet London could still find ways to push back against the system. But I'll cover that in a future chapter. Thanks for listening. Hope you found it entertaining and enjoyable. The Story of London exists as a free podcast open to everybody without adverts. If you can support us, you can make a donation on the Buy Me a Coffee contribution page that's linked to where you see the information for this podcast, I believe. And beyond that, if you can't give a contribution, don't worry about it. It'd be really nice if you could leave a nice review if you enjoy it. I'll be continuing on next week. And I'd like to thank my recent supporters, Mark, and above all, Mountain Spider Girl, for her amazing contribution the other week. Thank you for your continued support. Okay, that's enough of me. This is Saul saying see you next week for another chapter of The Story of London.